So this is an oral history interview with Dave Wegner in Tucson, Arizona on August 4th, 2017. And thanks for coming to meet with us today, Dave. Really appreciate it. And if you could just start, we were having a little chat about your background in public lands and policy. And if you would just sort of go back to that conversation and fill us in about your experiences, where you used to work, and how you originally got involved in the program.
Well, I think to put it in context, I should start kind of at the beginning.
Perfect.
First off, my name is Dave Wegner. It's W-E-G-N-E-R. I was recruited to come work in Duchesne, Utah in 1974 for the Utah Division of Wildlife. Specifically to work on the environmental impact statement for the Central Utah Project. That project was to take water out of the Green River system, essentially, on that side of the Colorado River Basin, and capture it all and ship it over to the Wasatch Front. So my job was looking at the aquatic ecology and the limnology, the water chemistry, of the rivers, of the lakes, and of the water, the reservoirs that the Bureau was intending to build or had already built. From 74 to 75 and a half, I worked for Utah, State of Utah, and then the Bureau of Reclamation hired me as an engineering technician. One of my degrees is in engineering. And they wanted me to work on helping build the dams that the Central Utah Project was building as part of that overall endeavor. I worked as an engineer for 2 years, and then decided if I was going to further my education, it was time to do it then, because I was going to get sucked into working forever if I don't go back to school when I had to or needed to. Went to Colorado State University, where I got a degree in it's called river engineering, but it was geomorphology related, how to rebuild rivers, specifically because the Bureau wanted me to look at how can we restructure rivers below dams after we've built dams, because they just were having terrible luck with fish species and biology and all kinds of things. So while I was going to Colorado State University and living in Fort Collins, I worked full-time for the Fish and Wildlife Service.
What years were that?
Oh, that would have been 77, probably the end of 77 through... No, it had to be like November of 77 to January of 1980. I got my master's degree there, and then the Bureau recruited me to come back to work for them in Salt Lake City at the regional office, where I worked on the regional water quality staff, looking specifically at setting up the reservoir monitoring program for all the reservoirs in the Upper Colorado River Basin. So that's what I did. That's when I started working on Lake Powell, Flaming Gorge, the dams and reservoirs on the Gunnison System, Fontanelle Reservoir in Wyoming. So I got to know the watershed of the Upper Colorado River Basin intimately, and that was great.
Yeah.
Long or about 1982, the middle, probably fall of 82, we had a particularly sensitive Secretary of Interior by the name of Jim Watt, who was having chronic foot and mouth disease over his proclamations that he wanted to put additional generators on Glen Canyon Dam. He wanted to do that without doing NEPA. He wanted to do it without having to worry about the Endangered Species Act, because that's how it had always been done. Keep in mind, the Glen Canyon Dam was authorized by Congress on April 11th, 1956. Never had any NEPA compliance. Didn't have to. There wasn't a law then. Never had any ESA compliance, Clean Water Act, because those laws didn't exist. So this time around, Mr. Watt said, well, we're just going to put generators on the outlet works at Glen Canyon Dam, so we can increase. This was right after the energy crisis of the mid to late 70s, when we needed more energy. The United States was looking to get out from underneath the yoke of foreign oil, et cetera, et cetera. And they were going to develop energy everywhere. 1977, the Department of Energy. In fact, today is the anniversary of the Department of Energy going into business. Department of Energy took all the Bureau Reclamation power marketing jobs that we used to have in the Bureau, and those were all transferred to the Department of Energy. And that's when Western Area Power Administration became the player that they are now. Is, you know, whatever how many years ago it is on today when the Department of Energy was authorized. But to make matters worse, the Department of Energy was populated now by a bunch of old Bureau guys that said, well, we don't need this environmental stuff. We'll just go do it. Well, they come to find out they had a particularly sensitive meeting in Page, Arizona, where the environmental community, now knowing that the National Environmental Policy Act was in place and they had rights to open, transparent process, that they called them out. And another particularly sensitive person from the Bureau of Reclamation stood up and said, the Bureau buildeth, the Bureau can taketh away. And that blew up, coming back all around to Congressman George Miller, who at that point was climbing up the ranks in the House of Representatives. He still is heavily involved in public land issues, especially Western public land and water issues. Had run-ins with the Bureau of Reclamation in the past, and he said, you can't do that. And so the either Congress was going to implement some sort of requirement on the Bureau at Glen Canyon Dam, or they were going to get sued by the environmental community. And at that point, Secretary Watt basically decided, well, I got to give myself some cover to protect this process. I still want to put these generators on there. Let's just do the minimal amount of environmental compliance we have to, which is an environmental assessment. And so the environmental assessment was initiated on December 8th, 1982. Part of that was that they were initiating what's called the Glen Canyon Environmental Studies. So that's where that came from. At that point, I had already been working at Lake Powell on water quality stuff through the regional office. I had already started working below Glen Canyon Dam when I was with the Fish and Wildlife Service in Fort Collins, looking at trying to figure out what's the minimum flow, used to call it the minimum in-stream flow, that the Bureau needed to release from the dam to support the trout fishery that the Bureau of the Fish and Wildlife Service and Arizona Game and Fish had initiated after the closure of Glen Canyon Dam. At least as I was told, there were several folks in the regional office who were contacted by Washington and said, we need to do some environmental studies below the dam to give us cover. We're going to do the minimum amount possible. Select somebody from the region who will go down there and initiate that. Two engineers before me had turned it down because they said, that's a no-end job. I mean, it's not going to go anywhere. You know, and plus you're going to have to move to Page or some god-awful place, and who wants to go there? So I was asked by the Regional Environmental Office, Harold Surslin at the time, if I would consider taking this position. And Cliff Barrett was regional director. Bill Plummer had been regional director. Cliff had come in, and they basically, as Cliff later told me, they wanted to put somebody down there who they knew would never get anything done. And so being a biologist scientist, they knew that, you know, engineers are God in the Bureau of Reclamation. They've always been God. They always will be God. Scientists are, you know, we're so far down the totem pole, we don't even register. So I got selected to take that position on, but I was to be a staff of one. I wouldn't have any staff. I couldn't even have an office officially. They were wanting to move me to Flagstaff, Arizona, because that's where all the environmental conservation community was. They're the ones who were raising all the holy ruckus. They wanted to have somebody out there that could take the heat for the Bureau through all that. So, make a long story short, I took that job on. I moved to Flagstaff. My office, I was able to con then Gene Shoemaker, who was alive. I don't know if you know of Gene, but he was the man who discovered the Shoemaker-Levy comet out there, and he was the guy that brought the program to Flagstaff, the USGS to Flagstaff, to help train the astronauts out on Meteor Crater and those places, Sunset Crater and those areas. So Gene took a liking to me. Sue Kiefer was another scientist who took a shine into me. She gave me a corner of her lab at the Flagstaff USGS, and that's where GCS started, and it was me, staff of one. So, and then from there, of course, 1983 happened when we almost lost Glen Canyon Dam. So that changed the whole perspective on the studies. The studies were to be focused on initially and these were the categories I was given: sediment transport and physical hydrology, biology, and recreation. Go out and figure what to do. There was no direction. It was go figure out what to do. What do we need? Go talk to people. Just get out of here. Get out of Salt Lake. Go down there. Just make them see that the Bureau has somebody out there fumbling around on this stuff. It'll give us cover to do what Mr. Watt. By this time, Mr. Watt had been let go. He had put foot in mouth one too many times with Nancy Reagan, and he was gone. Don Hodel, who came from the power marketing arena, became the new Secretary of Interior. And for some reason, he kind of wanted to find out about issues in the West. And so we chatted a lot about dams and things like that. He, at that point, had been previously involved with the Columbia River dams. So he was already knowing the impact of dams through BPA and through the Power Marketing Administration up there to look at what some of the issues. And that's where, I know you want to get to adaptive management. Do you want to talk about the genesis of adaptive management in this country? It's the Pacific Northwest. That's where it started. It started with the Northwest Forest Plan, and it started coming out of the writings of Kai Lee and Carl Walters and everybody that was looking at those issues in the Pacific Northwest with the Columbia River. Because the Columbia, because of the salmon and the iconicness of the salmon, had this issue was on their radar screen far sooner than it was down in the south with humpback chub or squawfish or something that people couldn't eat and couldn't keep. If they did catch them, they had to let them go. So 1983, though, really changed the dynamic, because now the studies from just looking at the very narrow band that we were told to look at, which was the change of operation from present operating to what would happen if we added a couple of more generators to the river outlet tube. So it was a very narrow band. After 1983, the Bureau was in total chaos. And I was at the dam when all this was going on. So, you could see...
Are you talking about the flood year?
The flood. The 83 was right. The big flood year. And when it was the Saturday they had to go up to Page to go buy the marine plywood to throw on the top of the dam. I was up at the dam on that day, and you could just feel the dam rumbling. And when you saw chunks of concrete the size of Volkswagens, the old Volkswagens, flying out the spillway, and when you lost the sweep on the spillways, and then when the water turned red, you knew that the spillway tunnels had been compromised. The Bureau shut them down, put plywood on the upstream side of the spillway gates so we could put the reservoir into surcharge. So there was actually more water in the reservoir than it's designed to hold. But what came out of that is that the discussion that emerged, and I remember having this very discussion with Cliff Barrett and the commissioner at that point, was, well, you could shut down the studies and just say we've got bigger things to do. Or we could postpone the studies until the Bureau got through this state of emergency. In 83, actually 84 was a bigger year than 83. It was just the Bureau thought ahead in 84 to release more water all during the year rather than wait until May to start releasing water, which the dam was not designed as a flood control dam. It's designed as a storage dam. So it's not built like a Columbia River dam. So it's a whole different engineering perspective. Or the third option was we could embrace this opportunity and look at the whole range of operational issues at Glen Canyon Dam. The flood, so we could take into account the flood, we could take into account low flows, we could take into account operational changes that the Bureau may wish to look at down the road. So that was where the studies changed from being a very small entity to being a potentially a much larger entity as part of this. And as a result of that, the Bureau wanted me to include and embrace bringing other agencies into the process. Fish and Wildlife Service, U.S. Geologic Survey, other Bureau folks, Arizona Game and Fish, and a whole variety of other agencies that have issues associated with the operation and maintenance, Western Area Power, of Glen Canyon Dam. So I still didn't have staff, but at least I had the opportunity to go out and get cooperating partners, shall we say. And so out of that, we began to implement the studies, and I hired Arizona Game and Fish, whoever's necessary. The key thing to all this, and included in the December 8th, 1982 memorandum, was that this shall be paid for through power revenues, which took me off books, which was critical. Because if I had to go through Congress every year to get an appropriations in the Bureau of Reclamation budget, I worked in the House of Representatives. I know how this goes down. And if somebody doesn't like what you're doing, they just don't give you the money to do it. Having an opportunity to use the checkbook of Glen Canyon Dam and the Colorado River Storage Project was the most critical thing we did. And you see that, and if you go up and talk to any of the folks who work on the Columbia, they'll tell you the same thing. The fact that we have revenue, dedicated revenue to us from the generation of hydroelectricity. So all of a sudden it makes the hydro piece of this a partner. And so they want to be engaged, and you want them engaged, but it also gives you opportunity every year to get dollars that didn't require me to go through appropriations.
Was that December 1982 decision an act of Congress or a decision by the Reclamation?
It was a decision by the Secretary of Interior.
Secretary of Interior.
I got a memo in there someplace from Jim Watt.
And it's never been rescinded. That's amazing.
No. There's times. I mean, between you and me and the fence post and the recorder, I ran into Jim Watt. Gosh, where was I? I was in the Salt Lake City Airport. I want to say 96, 97, somewhere in there. And we got to chatting. I went up and reintroduced myself because the last time I had actually talked with him was he was Secretary of Interior. I was in the Secretary's office. And his direction to me was, you're going to go down there and do environmental studies in the Grand Canyon, but we're never going to change the way we operate Glen Canyon Dam. This is the way we've done things. We're always going to do it. And his statement was, if I start opening up Glen Canyon Dam to environmental review, it means I got to open up all the other dams to environmental review. They didn't want to do that. No way, no how. Because all of a sudden it would let a bunch of conservation types, the David Browers of the world, all of a sudden have a say in how the dam is managed and operated. So sitting in front of his fireplace and having his finger pointing at me, you know, come forward a few years, meeting him in the Salt Lake City airport, and he said, I just should have given you a brown bag full of money and told you to go away. You know, instead of giving you the access to the power revenue checkbook, and because it changed the whole dynamic of how I looked at how we were going to do business. Keep in mind, there was the Bureau in this time was going through a lot of grief trying to get Glen Canyon repaired. Glen Canyon wasn't the only dam that was negative, was having problems. So they were running around the region, literally looking at other dams because this could happen again.
Hadn't Teton Dam just failed a few years before?
Teton had collapsed in 76. I was working for the Bureau in Duchesne when it went down, and I got sent to St. Anthony, Idaho, to look at the devastation. And that put a crimp in the Bureau's gate, so to speak. But Glen Canyon was even worse because it was close to losing. I don't know if you would ever lost the whole dam, but it would have had a significant impact on a lot of the dam structure itself and resources downstream.
Everything downstream.
But the dam is a sieve as it is where it's built. It's built in sandstone that leaks, and there's nothing you can do about that. At least Hoover Dam is built in granite, and it's solid. It's going to go over the top of Hoover and probably destroy the power plant down below, but the dam will stay. Glen Canyon, not so much, because just the way it's constructed and where it's constructed. But that being said, we began the process, and along about, I want to say, 86, 87, the Assistant Secretary for then Water and Science. I don't know if it was Water and Science, but I think that was the name then, called me up and said, the Bureau is, and the Department of Interior is going to dedicate a couple $100,000 to this new entity called the Water Science Technology Board of the National Academy of Sciences. We don't have any clue of what we want them to do. Might you have some idea on how to use the Academy of Sciences? And, you know, I may be dumb, but I ain't stupid. I jumped on that, and this was a brand new board that had been set up. They were looking at issues with the Bureau, the Corps, EPA, etc. And we had already, I had already felt that we, our science needed to be bolstered up a lot. Nothing against people from Arizona Game and Fish or from the Fish and Wildlife Service or the Bureau, but we were just making up science as we went in the Grand Canyon, and that's not a good way to do science. We had to have a plan. We had to think about how we were approaching issues, how, if our studies were going to stand the test of credibility. So it really gave me an opportunity then, getting engaged in with the Academy of Sciences, to get a broader perspective on how science could be, should be, was necessary to be done in the Grand Canyon. We got hammered by the Academy of Science. Oh God, we got hammered. Because we weren't doing that good of science. I mean, it was agency science. It was not plan out hypotheses, do credible reviews and development, go out there, collect it, in a credible manner, in a robust manner, go through peer review to make sure it was, and we, it took us a couple of years to come out of our first review from the Academy, and I've got one of the books in there, but it's, I'm sure you've had access to all those, but it made us better scientists. And so at this point, they had jerked me back to Salt Lake because they didn't like the fact that I was getting a little too close to the scientists, and they wanted me to be removed from the scientist. And so that went, you know, I went back to Salt Lake for a while from Flagstaff, and then come back around to George Miller. George Miller was now chairman of the Natural Resources Committee in the House of Representatives. He had taken over from Mo Udall, who had just rescinded. Mo was almost ready to pass away, and George and his staff director, first it was George and his subcommittee staff director, Dan Beard, who called me and said, the chairman would like to know more about what's going on in the Grand Canyon. So that's when I first started interacting more with Dan. I had known him before, met him before, when he was part of the Carter administration earlier on, but I didn't really work with him. Now I was starting to work with Dan. And then when Dan got elevated to staff director for the whole Natural Resources Committee, Dan had considerable clout in being able to get George out in front on issues, and he wanted to get George Miller out in front on issues. So we started having these discussions, and I'd get called back to Washington to brief them probably once every quarter, every 3 or 4 months, to go back and just keep the congressman and his folks informed of what was going on.
Is this still 1980?
These are the early 80s. Middle to the, well, it was probably 84, 85, somewhere in there. Concurrent with this, and the reason George Miller had moved up to being a powerful person in the Natural Resources Committee. George was going after the Bureau big time in California over the water issues, and to this day it's still one of George's pet peeves, on how the Bureau of Reclamation literally, and still does, subsidize Westlands Water District and all the big guys who own tremendous, they're mega millionaires out there, who are getting subsidized federal power and making huge money over this hand over fist. Plus then we subsidize them for crops on top of it. So they're just, and George always, and it was always a burr under his saddle. And so anything that involved the Bureau of Reclamation, what was the next thing after California? Well, and California had just gone through Kesterson Reservoir, the water quality issues out right there, where Dave Houston, the then regional director, was foot and mouth disease time and got exposed on 60 Minutes for lying about water quality. And so George was after the Bureau. So George adopted me, more or less, because I was, you know, I was the next river over. I was the Colorado River. We were working on these issues, and we were proving the Bureau had been operating that dam without any consideration for downstream resources, whether it's the Grand Canyon beaches, whether it was archaeological resources, whether it was endangered fish, whether it was, you know, whatever was going on downstream, the Bureau could care less. The Bureau had also picked a fight with the National Park Service over impacts associated with the operation of the dam. And then there was a superintendent by the name of Dick Marks. Dick Marks did not like the Bureau because the Bureau would never do what the Park Service wanted the Bureau to do in the with Glen Canyon Dam to help mitigate some of the impacts that were going on in the Grand Canyon. And this was the years where they were fluctuating from highs of 34,000 to lows of 3,000 at night. So you had these huge swings, and boats were getting hung up, and beaches were exposed and then cutting away. And at one point, early on, the Glen Canyon environmental studies were to be located at Grand Canyon National Park. Hmm. Dick Marks said...
South Rim.
South Rim. He said, over my dead body, will I ever let a Bureau of Reclamation establish an office at Grand Canyon? So that's when I got pushed to Flagstaff. But so all this was going on, and George didn't like the Bureau. Park Service didn't like the Bureau. The Bureau had this big study now going on in the Grand Canyon, Glen Canyon Dam issues. We had the flood where we almost lost the dam in 83. Was costing three times what the Bureau estimated to fix the spillways. It was just, the Bureau was out of control. And George was going to use this leverage to help it. So anyway, we're down. I had been jerked back to Salt Lake. I think Rick Gold was an assistant regional director. I don't know who was at that point. But we were on a river trip downstream with, and then I think Jack Davis was superintendent of the park. I think Rick was on that. Rick Gold was on that trip. I think Ken Maxey from WALPA and George Miller. And we were at, George was, I could just see George getting more steamed and more steamed as we came downstream from Lees Ferry. He just didn't like what the Bureau was saying they were going to do with these studies, how, you know, we were going to roll this through and get a NEPA done real quick. Or no, we weren't going to do NEPA then. We're just not going to include NEPA at all. And how I was going to remain in Salt Lake so they could keep control of me. And George, we were at Grapevine Beach. To this day, I will remember this as long as I live. I brought George down a beverage, and I could just see that he was not happy. And he basically walked back up the beach after this beverage and sat down the guys and said, this is what's going to happen. Congress is going to start more oversight on the Glen Canyon studies. So, and he is moving back to Flagstaff. And if you don't like that, I do have control over your appropriations, Bureau of Reclamation, and you're going to start seeing a lot more things get thrown your way that you're not going to like. And so at that point, we all get down to Phantom.
What year was this?
I'm going to say this was 86, maybe 87, somewhere in there. But being what it may, I moved back down to Flagstaff for the second time at that point. And I was allowed then to start building part of a staff so we could get after this. George, true to George's word, kept this thing spun up in Washington. So much so that by 89, the Bureau and the Department were in a position where they were going to get Congress telling them how to operate Glen Canyon Dam again. They didn't want that. And I got a phone call late at night from the acting commissioner of Reclamation. He was obviously had a beverage or two and said, well, you got your damn EIS, and slammed the phone down. You know, being what it is, we had the EIS. We had the direction that we were going to do the environmental impact statement. And at this point, you know, it was clear that the Bureau was going to throw any hurdle they could in this to not make it succeed. So along with the National Academy of Sciences, I had, let's see if I can find it real quick. I had initiated a program where I brought together the representatives of the agencies and what I called the Executive Review Committee. Because I could see that I was going to get screwed and the studies were going to get screwed big time if I didn't have some folks who were above me, who knew what we were doing. And the Academy of Science said, you really should have, you know, some sort of organizational direction to this. And this is where the Executive Review Committee, this ultimately became what emerges today as the Adaptive Management Committee. It was only a group of five at that point, and it was only federal agencies plus Arizona Game and Fish. But I didn't have, there was nothing, you know, adaptive management. I was writing on adaptive management at this point. I brought it up to these folks, gave them presentations on it, starting to educate them, because I could see this is where ultimately, even if we, this was pre-NEPA, even if we didn't do NEPA, we had to come up with a better way to manage our patterns of operations at Glen Canyon Dam. So the Executive Review Committee became my forum, and we met quarterly, either in Albuquerque or Phoenix or Salt Lake or wherever the it needed to go, to make sure, and the Department of Interior was involved. So the Secretary's office was involved in the Executive Review Committee, and that was Pat Port out of San Francisco, their regional office in San Francisco. So at this point, and then we would go back to Washington periodically to give updates and reviews to the Secretary's office and to Congress and to members of Congress, so that knowing that this was still kind of expanding. After we got implemented into, roped into doing the full NEPA compliance, that changed the whole perspective of the program, because at that point, science needed to support the NEPA. And NEPA, they learned from how I ran the studies that they didn't want me to begin running the NEPA too. They knew that they did not want that. But I still had enough control through the other processes. So they tried a couple of folks. They brought in a guy from Washington, D.C. to do the NEPA. They, at that point, oh, I was moved back to Salt Lake again for this. And we actually set up this fella, Steve, what was his last name? I'll think of it here. He was, his claim to fame is he was dating Senator Paul Laxalt's daughter. So he would have this, and I had a staff of one at this point. I had a secretary who was assigned to keep watch over me and watch over Steve. They moved us out of the Bureau building because they didn't even want the NEPA in the Bureau Reclamation building in Salt Lake City. We were moved to the Key Bank building, which is downtown Salt Lake, but it used to be the old ZCMI area. I think it's all been now changed with the Mormons church bought all that and redeveloped it down there. But we were in the Key Bank building, so we were physically removed from the Bureau. They didn't want us even in the regional office because we were doing this NEPA on the sacred thing called Glen Canyon Dam. They knew that if we started NEPA, we're likely going to have to do some changes. They didn't want to be involved in that. So then Steve didn't work out. I was actually called over to the regional director's office and said, we got to fire this guy because he's not doing anything. I mean, he showed up at 10, was at the health club from 10:30 till 2, took a lunch and left at 3. So he was not a good... Then they brought in somebody from the Bureau of Indian Affairs to run it, and they brought in some folks from other agencies to try to run NEPA, and it just completely cratered. Because they just, you know, they couldn't work the Bureau system. And the Bureau does business a whole lot different than any other federal agency. And you got to know the culture, and you got to know what levers to pull to get things done in the Bureau. So this, and we still had the Academy of Science going on too. So I had that piece going on. We had the science going on. So we were still looking at, now that we were in the NEPA process, and because the science, the National Academy of Sciences had made a recommendation that I hire a senior level scientist. So I did. I went out and hired somebody off the committee, off their committee, Duncan Patton from ASU.
Yes.
And his little, he was in a little shopping center west of main campus in Tempe. Hmm. There was a little shopping center place. There was a health club there and there was a restaurant. we'd go get coffee, and Paul, I can't think of his last name, was also, there was two or three people that were part of Duncan's environmental staff there. Mm-hmm. So I hired Duncan to be the senior scientist. So Duncan and I began this whole process of really charting out what the Academy wanted to see as good science, what the Bureau wanted to see, needed to have to do a NEPA compliance. Now, the way the Bureau was hamstringing the NEPA process is they just slowballed it. So we had three or four people who came in, they tried to run NEPA, and it just wasn't going anywhere because the Bureau wasn't going to throw any muscle behind this, and they kept bringing in people that couldn't do the job. But meantime, the science was going on. And about 1990-91, Grand Canyon Trust and a couple of other organizations was starting to get upset that this thing wasn't moving faster. It was started in 89. The NEPA compliance was, it should be moving along, and it wasn't. So for a lot of reasons, there was one big lawsuit. This is a good point, because it actually is one of the reasons the Bureau felt they had to do the NEPA. I want to say in the spring of 88, maybe the middle of 88, a lawsuit was filed against Western Area Power Administration because the WAPA was reinstituting power contracts for the Colorado River Storage Project. Periodically, you have to go out and issue new power contracts for your people who are buying your electricity. A lawsuit was made against WAPA that these contracts impacted how the Bureau operated the dam. And for a lot of reasons, of course, the Bureau said, no, we operate the dam anyway. We want to operate the dam because we're the Bureau. WAPA said, well, we think we just tell the Bureau we have a contract and this is what you got to do. That's what they got sued over, is that those power contracts were really important to driving how the operations of the dam really resulted in the hour-by-hour issue. The Bureau said, well, we operate it on an annual basis and on a monthly basis. That's the parameters we give to WAPA. And then WAPA figures out the hourly, minute-by-minute, day-by-day, based on what the power grid needs. And it's really those contracts that were driving this huge fluctuation that you saw at Clean Canyon Dam. Well, that's another place where I got sideways to the Bureau, because I got called as a witness by the people who were suing the Bureau in WAPA. So here I am. I'm in a courtroom being deposed, and then in a courtroom in Salt Lake City, federal court, basically asking and being asked by the judge, do the operations of Glen Canyon Dam have an impact on the downstream environment, physical, biological, recreation? The data was clear. I can't lie. Absolutely it does. And he said, well, can you, and we had some videos that we had taken and slides and such, so I gave this whole interesting little tangent to this. The lawyer for all of this was
For the plaintiffs was
Ty Cobb, who is today just been announced as the President of the United States lawyer. That's the Ty Cobb that's representing Donald Trump right now. Got appointed, two, three weeks ago? Anyway, Ty and I became great friends because he knew I had the answer. And he is the grandson of Ty Cobb, the baseball player. And he is pugnacious. He will rip you a new one. And he's very, very good at it. We developed a friendship. About the same time, Grand Canyon Trust had emerged, and Ed Norton was the executive director of Grand Canyon Trust. Bruce Babbitt was one of the founding members of Grand Canyon Trust. This was right before Mr. Clinton was elected president. So Bruce was involved in this. He was governor of Arizona. He would come down I would run into him on weekends in the Grand Canyon because he liked to go hike in the Grand Canyon. And he actually broke one of my cable cars in the Grand Canyon, which he's never paid for, by the way. But his Secret Service guys, or his governor security guy at that point. Anyway, it was... So Bruce was, and the Grand Canyon Trust were pushing this. You had this lawsuit with that the plaintiffs won. and WAPA had to initiate NEPA compliance, well, that was the death knell for Glen Canyon, for the Bureau, because they knew that if they were going to have to do NEPA compliance on operations, that they were going to get roped into doing NEPA compliance on Glen, on the whole operations of Glen. So that's how the NEPA process really got structured and why they didn't want me to run it, because I was already on the outer side because I had been called
to as witness.
And so it was always an interesting, I was being cross-examined by a Department of Justice lawyer while my lawyer was Ty Cobb. You know, it's just, I don't know how all this worked out, but it did for a lot of reasons. But so the Executive Review Committee was trying to transition out, knowing they'd have to go to a NEPA process, but they were still involved almost all the way through the thing. We had the National Academy of Sciences continuing to put out their reports. And then out of all of this, the Grand Canyon Protection Act was born. And its genesis was on a beach in Grand Canyon, where Ed Norton and I actually talked about the need to do a Grand Canyon Protection Act in the old Howard Johnson's restaurant in Flagstaff on Route 40 there. Mm-hmm. One evening, we told me to talk till 3 in the morning. Well, I had a lot of coffee that night over what a Grand Canyon Protection Act might look like and what did it need to include and how might that look. And of course, if it had been public that I was working with Grand Canyon Trust or any of these folks. But Ed and I had a relation. You know, when you were a staff of, and you were on your own, and there was nobody literally to supervise me, I went out and did what I felt was right. I didn't do it if it was the Bureau way or anything else. I just wanted to get the job done and make sure that we were doing what was right for the Grand Canyon. And so out of that, the Grand Canyon Protection Act was born. It took a couple of times to get it passed. It was finally passed in 92 as part of a larger omnibus bill. But that is where the genesis of adaptive management that then became embraced in the EIS began. And if you go and look at the committee reports and everything that goes along with it, this concept, and keep in mind that I had been going back to Washington and doing briefings for folks, and I would always bring up, we got to do monitoring and science different after we get through this, folks, because we're not going to be able to know everything going into this. And I, at that point, had already started reading what they were doing in the Northwest and around the country on this concept at that point of adaptive management and how we might structure that. And along about 87, I remember making a presentation to the Executive Review Committee about adaptive management. This is what they're doing in the North Pacific Northwest. This is what they're trying to do. And these are the reasons why they're doing it there and why we might want to consider it. So George Miller wanted to make sure it was captured in the Grand Canyon Protection Act, which it was. And then it began to become a focal point in the NEPA document, NEPA process too. So the reason this had to go is because in here, the other part that's important of the Grand Canyon Protection Act is it gave an endpoint to the NEPA process. It said you will be done by the end of 1996. So that being said, it gave us now a timeline. The Bureau couldn't wiggle out of this, even though they could make it look bad. They couldn't get out of doing NEPA compliance by just slow walking it. So the timeline was set. Duncan Patton had been hired as a senior scientist. Duncan and I met almost every week down at ASU on some issue or another, because we were really trying to ramp up the studies to meet now the NEPA need. And that's when we got into this idea of doing interim flows. We needed to have 11-day periods of certain flow regimes and have scientists spread out in the canyon to look at what different flow regime, ultimately they became the elements of the alternatives that were in the EIS. So we did a whole, for a year and a half, we did various ramping rates, differences, highs, lows, seasonal, looking at seasonal pieces, and every 10 days we were up in a helicopter flying the Grand Canyon, taking pictures as the flows dropped out to see what the beaches had done, mm-hmm. see where backwaters were, see where different issues had arisen with rapids, and you know, whether rapids were debris flows, or looking at the science and how all this was put together.
So, can I ask for some clarification on that? So, who provided the authority to force the Bureau to do those flows that the scientists said we'd like to? It was the Grand Canyon Protection Act.
The Grand Canyon Protection Act gave the endpoint.
Uh-huh.
And backing up from when you had to have a draft done, and then when you had to get the science done, we only had a couple of years to physically get the science that we needed. And Duncan and I both agreed the only way we're going to do this, if they wanted us to look at a variety of alternatives, was to run a series of alternatives. So the authority came from the fact that the Bureau had to abide by the Grand Canyon Protection Act. Now, they were under a lawsuit at the other end that said, you will do NEPA. So it wasn't, if they knew that if they didn't do NEPA, they were going to get sued, and now Congress was going to take even more control if they weren't satisfied. So,
and a new administration is coming in about that time, right?
And lo and behold, who becomes commissioner of the Bureau of Reclamation? Dan Beard.
Staff person for George Miller. Right?
Exactly. He had been staff director for George Natural Resources Committee. So Dan went down to be commissioner. He didn't necessarily, he was offered the position of assistant secretary. He didn't take that because he said, I want a position where I have some money or I can do something with. And Dan, being Dan, he's a go-getter. He goes in and fixes things. He's always been a fixer. But he's good for about 2 to 3 years. Before then, he gets tired of it and he wants to move on to the next challenge. So he told me he had 2 years probably in as commissioner, and that, oh, by the way, you're now working for me as commissioner. Even though your paycheck comes out of the regional office, you report to me. So you want to know who the authority was? It was Dan Beard, the commissioner. They said, "You whatever you need, you got it." And Bruce Babbitt at that point was Secretary of Interior.
Right.
So Bruce was interested in this because of the Grand Canyon, and, you know, his relationship with it. Secretary of Interior, Arizona boy, the Grand Canyon Protection Act was sponsored by not only George Miller, but John McCain. So Senator McCain and I became very good friends, and his staff, we talked a lot. Senator Braill Bradley, who was in the Senate at that point, in the committee that was over on the Senate side for the same thing. Tom Jensen, who worked for Senator Bradley, became very interested in the Grand Canyon, more because he liked to do river trips. I didn't necessarily start out this way, but I ended up this way, cultivating the Beltway so that they supported what we were doing. And that worked great for a while. But then, you know, you get that phone call from your boss and friend, Dan Beard, one day and said, well, I'm leaving. I've had enough. I don't want to take any more of this. Because he was getting a lot of pushback from Babbitt on issues. More because at that point, Bill Clinton was secretary. Gore was vice president. Gore had instituted a program called the Golden Hammer Award, where he was going to go up and clean up the government. You know, get rid of, there used to be the old Golden Fleece Award that William Proxmire had.
Right.
Well, Al Gore had the Golden Hammer Award. And so he wanted people, and Dan Beard was his poster child, because Dan went through and completely redid how the Bureau of Reclamation was managed and created a whole lot of enemies in the Bureau. To this day, the Bureau is full of people who hate Dan Beard because he changed the way the Bureau did business. He got him out, you know, he closed the Yuma desal plant. So we're done with that quite often. We're not going to do, because it's not cost effective, it's never going to be cost effective. It's been a white elephant from day one, it's going to always. He did things in California, and he took on the Colorado River issue. And there's a lot of people in the Bureau who don't still for that. But I became, again, you know, I was working for Dan. So I was put on the outside and wasn't necessarily engaged on a lot of the internal discussions that they were having in Washington. The next secretary or the next commissioner wasn't quite as engaged. He was from New Mexico, but wasn't as engaged. And Eulid Martinez was the next commissioner who came on to replace Dan. Nice guy from New Mexico. If I wanted a grandfather, he'd be it. Really nice guy, but just was not, purposely, he was not Dan Beard. And Bruce didn't want somebody like a Dan Beard as commissioner again. So all of this, and so adaptive management, and then the Bureau decided they were going to have the Denver office kind of be the point on the NEPA process. And that's when Tim Randall and that crew started the physical writing of NEPA out of the Denver Technical Service
Center. Why did they move it from Salt Lake City, I presume, would have been?
Because they had, Salt Lake had failed miserably in this whole process.
In completing the EIS.
Yeah, and bringing people, and trying to hire people to write the EIS, they just could not get their proverbial act together. And for a lot of reasons, it got, and Dan was one of them, they got moved to Denver. And Tim Randall and company picked it up, and they did a great job, I think, the world. Tim worked for me in the Grand Canyon early on, so I've known Tim a long time.
And so we're now in the mid-1990s?
Yeah, we're in the mid. Well, probably in 93, 94 era in there.
How long was Dan commissioner? From 93 to...
Well, let me see. When did Clinton come in? 93. He was 2 years, so he left in 95.
Okay.
Right before we got to the real heavy part, lifting part. But it was all right, because he had gotten us through the piece we needed to have cover for. And we needed a lot of cover in those days because people were not happy that we were playing around with flows, trying to do the science. The Academy of Science kept pushing us to do more issues associated with that. Congress was becoming more engaged and wanted to have a dialogue on this for a lot of reasons. And so and the studies had gotten some notoriety because of what we were doing. People from all over the world, everybody wants to go to the Grand Canyon and see what was going on, and so we were getting a lot of push on this. And then out of this, for two years prior to 96, Duncan and myself and the scientific group said, we really need to do a physical test of adaptive management. We think we need to do an experimental flood of some sort to redistribute sediments, because the beaches were going in the Grand Canyon at an alarming rate. Some of it was because of the interim flows that we instituted. Some of it because it was just the nature, we don't have any sediment coming into the system anymore. And the system had caught up. When we started the program after the early, before the flood in 83, the system had been slowly pushing the sediment out of Marble Canyon at rates. But nobody was monitoring at that point.
Mm-hmm.
So we knew the beaches were getting smaller downstream.
But no numbers.
After 83, the first flood in 83, there were huge beaches in the Grand Canyon. Because all that sediment that was on the bottom of the river got churned up by 90,000 cubic feet per second and redeposited high. So they were, I shouldn't probably tell you this, but they were landing airplanes down in National Canyon. There was a lot of stuff going on. This was before the air rules came in at Grand Canyon National Park. There was he's dead now, so I can use his name. Martin Litton was well known for flying his airplane up and down the canyon and dropping ice cream for his crew. Martin and I became great friends in later life. I have one of his original dories in Durango, so he was a mentor to me in many different ways. In fact, the fall of 1983, there was so this was after the big flood, there was a outfitters meeting at the South Rim. This is where the concessionaires who have the contracts for running river trips in the Grand Canyon, they used to get together every fall, usually December, at the South Rim of the Grand Canyon. And the superintendent will give them, this is how you're going to operate in my park. And it was Dick Marks, superintendent. So it was, this is how you're going to operate in my park, sort of thing. And Martin and Georgie White, I don't know if you ever heard of Georgie White. They decided they needed to figure out, nobody trusted the Bureau. The Bureau was hated by the concessionaires, by everybody, for probably good reasons. But they decided they needed to learn a little bit more about the Bureau and who I was and whether they could talk to me. So we closed the bar at El Tovar a couple of nights running. And over many martinis, Martin said, well, I don't necessarily trust the Bureau, but I trust you. So I'm going to give you stuff. I'm going to feed you stuff. A lot of old photographs, things like that, of what the river was like beforehand. So... long story short, there were several people who did that for the studies because they appreciated...
Provided historical information about the changing river conditions.
A lot of historicals. They would never give it to the Bureau, but they would give it to the Glen Canyon studies. because they saw that we were down there trying to do our best. And we were fumbling around, and we admitted when we fumbled a lot. And so we had to rebuild on a lot of the process that we were, and we were learning as we were going. We were true adaptive management from day one. We learned as we went. We made tons of mistakes. We learned from those mistakes, and we moved forward. But out of all of this process, the staff of the Glen Canyon studies went from being two or three of us to, I had 160 scientists around the country working on this program. So we had exploded exponentially in my mind on how we were doing the work to meet up to these needs. Adaptive management became that focal point of the EIS because it needed to be there to be different. And if you look at the original biological opinions for the Columbia system, they don't talk about adaptive management. Adaptive management didn't come in until, really, in terms of a government dams perspective, until Glen Canyon. Now it's embraced all over the place, and I'm so happy for that because it needs to. Is it perfect? Absolutely not. But it gives you a framework of process. So the first flood, it got shot down the first time because there were threats of lawsuits. It got shot down the second time because Trout Unlimited was going to sue the Bureau over impacts to the trout fishery below the dam, even though it's an exotic species in a river below a dam. But nonetheless, the Bureau wasn't going to go there. But we did get it the third time. And I remember Bruce Babbitt calling me up and saying, well, I wasn't going to come out, but now that you've gotten the court approval to go ahead with this experimental flood in March of 96, I'm going to come out. And so, literally, I met Bruce at the whatever the hotel is, right, coming off the out of Page on the way to the dam. We had dinner that night and chatted about a bunch of things. But he was down at the base of the dam in the morning on Good Morning America and whatever, the Today Show. And rightfully so. Secretary of Interior, he ought to take all the credit for this. And so the flood, it went off. And so he wanted, all of a sudden, Bruce became very interested in what was going on below the dam, now that he knew we were gonna finish an EIS, so he was going to be able to report to Congress on a positive note. We weren't going to get sued, because that had been put away by the judge, saying they can do the flood, so to speak, and that we were getting a lot of credits all over the world. And he was being asked to speak on what was going on in the Colorado River and how his administration was changing the way the Bureau did business through Dan Beard, even though Dan had left by this time. And so Bruce was, fairly emphatic that we were going to continue on this. And in fact, the evening before the flood started, he and I had a long, we went up, we got off the river, I had taken a river trip with all the press and everybody from Glen Canyon Dam down to Lee's Ferry. And there were a bunch of people on that trip, a bunch of dignitaries and politicians and press, etc. And so Bruce and I, we walked up to the cemetery at Lee's Ferry. Pretty sacred spot. It is to me, at least. That's where the folks who ran Lee's Ferry, that's where they're buried. It's a pretty sacred spot. And we had a discussion that basically said, I'm so happy with what has happened here, but we want to take what you've done here at the Glen Canyon Studies, and we want to expand that to become a much bigger program across the Bureau of Reclamation. And we want you guys, we now are going to have to set up this Grand Canyon Monitoring Center, because that's what he had agreed to do. And it's going to be set up in Flagstaff. But we're going to keep your crew together, basically, to do this adaptive management concept around the Bureau for a lot of reasons that I won't go into. That didn't quite work out as he had told us it would work out. And at that point, Bruce was under a lot of pressure because Congress had flipped and Newt Gingrich was now Speaker of the House. Newt was no way, no how going to let Bruce's biological survey survive. It wasn't going to happen. So Bruce was left trying to figure out how to take, and his whole concept was to set up the biological survey to be a replicate of the U.S. Geological Survey. So it's going to be a separate entity. So ultimately, when Gingrich took away the money, took away the ability for Babbitt to do his job, essentially. It forced Babbitt to take the eight regional directors he had already selected to run the survey and repopulate them in back into what's now the USGS. And that's when all the scientists in the Park Service, Fish and Wildlife Service, the Bureau, all those got assimilated into the USGS. So the science programs in all the agencies got cut off at the knees. So it was a bad deal. It wasn't Bruce's fault, but it was kind of his fault that it ended up this way. And Gingrich and others made sure that science was, in my mind, forever changed in the Department of the Interior. We had Flood, adaptive management work. I got called back to Washington a bunch of times to talk about it, and for a lot of reasons, we decided to part ways. But adaptive management, the first full-scale national experiment for adaptive management was the Flood.
That 1996,
March 1996
experimental Flood.
And we had more science going on, and I had trips on the river for post and pre, post, during, flying helicopters in and out all the time, and it was a great time to be a scientist, because we didn't know what to expect. Nobody had ever done this before. Nobody. So, we had people from all over the country, all over the world, who came to see or participate in this. The nice thing that we were able to do, that they decided they never would allow this again, is that I coupled the power revenue money with other funds. So I had EPA money, I had money from National Geographic Society, I brought in money from five or six sources to augment the basic science money. And that really gave us flexibility to do the kind of adaptive management that we felt we needed to do.
Was that how you got from a handful of researchers and studies to 160?
Yeah, part of that was bringing in alternative funding. And going out and getting academia to step up and say, I'll give you options to come on river trips and do science, the kind of science we need, if you'll, backfill some of the costs for your research people. Mm-hmm. We worked out a lot of deals like that they can't do now. They won't do now. So it's just, but again, nobody gave us any direction. Mm-hmm. But being involved with the National Academy of Sciences gave me a perspective on how you could work this. Because the Academy at this point was starting to work on the Everglades, they were doing work on the Mississippi after the floods in the Mississippi in the early 90s, working on the Columbia. So I got exposed to a much broader context of scientists working on these large ecosystem-based programs that I never would have if I had stayed insulated just within the Bureau. So to this day, the Academy now has me on their board working on this issue. And specifically, they've asked me to come and work on adaptive management. But they want to make that a key part of the new Water Science Technology Board approach, is how can we take adaptive management and apply it elsewhere? Part of that was because now, fast forward, I left the Department of the Interior on December 31st, 1996, had my own consulting firm that I started up, where I focused on river engineering and looking at issues around the world. So I went to Siberia, to Japan, all over the world, looking Costa Rica, looking at how to reoperate dams. Out of that, then, here comes George Miller back into my life. We have a new president who was elected, Mr. Obama. Mr. Obama had George Miller as one of his transition folks. George was responsible for helping to spool up what was going to be the Department of the Interior. And knowing that Ken Salazar was going to be secretary, so Ken was kind of doing his thing at his level, George wanted somebody to work with on the Hill who could be the conduit for Congress working on with the agency, somebody who knew the agency. So you had to know the agencies inside and out. You had to know where the skeletons were buried. You had to know how to work at that level and how to be able to communicate with them. Somebody who also knew how to communicate with the scientific world. So the National Academy of Sciences, the AAAS, all the quasi, all the organizations who are on the science side of academia who deal with water. So George calls me up and says, the president wants us to make a big push on this area with Western water issues, specifically Indian water settlements.
Mm-hmm.
We want to look at dam operations and river operations. And, oh, by the way, we want you to come back to work on the Hill. We want to place you in Congress so you're on staff so that you have direct access to all 435 members to help see what we can do in this arena. And so we did. And at that point, we also had, we were implementing the Recovery Act. So there was a lot of money that needed to go out into energy field, the water programs. You know, we're trying to get America back on its feet again after the debacle of the recession. So that was on my agenda too. So I came back and said, okay, George, you need to give me some help because I've not worked on the Hill a whole, I mean, I've been to the Hill, given a lot of briefings, but I've not worked on the Hill. He said, don't worry about it. I got you covered. So George was my person on the Hill when I first got there.
And who were you working for when you came
I was back? Working actually for the committee, a Natural Resources Committee, George's old committee. He said, because that's
House.
Where the Bureau is. Yeah, the House of Representatives. Because that's where the Bureau is physically, administratively located under the Natural Resources Committee. At that point, Nick Rahal had taken over. George had moved over to education, but George and Nick were and still are great friends. And so George convinced Nick to hire me to come back and do this. So that's what I did.
Did you have a specific position working
yeah,
in adaptive
staff.
Management? Or
no,
staff?
I was staff. I was staff director.
Staff director
for the Water and Power Subcommittee. It was specifically over the Bureau and the Western Water Settlements and the programs that are part of Western Water in particular. So out of that, I began working with all the members who are interested in this area. Continued the dialogue with the Academy of Sciences, the AAAS, and starting to bring up our level of knowledge on the House staff side. Because I hate to say this, but there's very few staff in the House of Representatives that, A, know there's a country west of the 100th Meridian. They're just, most of them are East Coast policy. They come out of the schools that churn out policy people in the East. Or B, know that Western water is different than Eastern water. And that's managed differently. There's a whole different set of water laws.
Mm-hmm.
And that the Native Americans, the Indian tribes, have a Federal Reserve water right. And that we have an obligation because we established a treaty with them. And if they're federally recognized, we have to work with them to make sure they're taken care of. So those were the big areas that I was asked to jump into right away.
By any chance, did you work on the White Mountain Apache Tribes?
Yeah.
Water? Okay.
And Kirkpatrick was congresswoman early on in that, yeah. Yeah. And Salt River Project and
mm-hmm.
others were all, and I've worked on a lot of these issues over the years. So that came on. Then we had another revolution of sorts in the House, and we lost the House, and the Republicans took over. At that point, I was asked to go over to the Transportation and Infrastructure Committee so I could take what I was doing with natural resources and apply it to the Corps of Engineers, EPA, FEMA, the other federal agencies. And George, again, called up and said, I would really like you to go over. And Nick Rahal called up and said, I'd really like you to come with me, because Nick had now migrated over to become the ranking member on TNI. And because... the congressman from Minnesota had lost his race, and
TNI,
Transportation Infrastructure. So it gave me this additional national perspective, and so we started to bring the concept of adaptive management into the Corps of Engineers,
mm-hmm.
EPA, and the other St. Lawrence Sea, you know, all the various Tennessee Valley Authority was under that subcommittee, and so all of that became part of the group that I was asked to work with. So as part of that, then, I got interested in, again, adaptive management. So I had this great group of graduate students of sorts. Oh, they're much more they're professional people at the Library of Congress called the Congressional Research Service. So lo and behold, I found out one day I could just call them up and say, I need you to do a report for me on this issue or another issue or whatever. And I did. So I learned, and they were constantly coming into my office, them and GAO, because we had kept asking them to do stuff for us. So out of that, I commissioned the Congressional Research Service to start doing reviews on adaptive management around the world, around the country.
So this is like 2010, 2011?
Well, this first report came out in October 21st, 2010. Adaptive Management in Ecosystem Restoration Initiatives. So, and Glen Canyon's one of the programs that I had them review, but I also had them look at the Platte River, Missouri River, Everglades, Lower Colorado Multi-Species Program, a whole variety. And then I had them list the benefits and the difficulties. I wanted to really learn, get a kind of a lessons learned from this. So one of the nice things about being former staff is I can still call up and have them do these sorts of things, as long as I have a member sign a letter. And so they're finishing up the second version of this now, where I've had them go back and explore again. Let's cast a broader net over where adaptive management has been applied. Because now you see it, you see those two words in almost every NEPA document now that has to do with water or environmental management, or you're even seeing it now populate into energy reports, etc. So, because the energy companies are getting into it. So, what I find is that I have members who I still consult with on a fairly regular basis in Washington who are smart people, and I know you got to get going, smart people in your own time, but on their own right, but they don't understand the concepts of how these things are applied. So, I still provide a service to members where I'll go in and explain things to them. They'll call me up and say, when you're in Washington next, can you come in and explain how this works in simple terms that I'll understand? And that's not a derogatory statement about our members of Congress, just the fact they got so many things coming at them that to explain to them the nuances of what we wrote in 92 and how it's played out and what it now, how it affects what they are going to be taking their little plastic card and voting on at some point, that's my job still. Once a staffer, always a staffer.
Yeah.
You educate and continue to educate both them and the staff over how these things are applied. And so this concept of adaptive management is getting enough airtime that it's now becoming part of the discussion. But again, they don't understand it all the time, what it means and what its implications are to a particular issue or project or case. So helping to explain that for them is what I do. So, and now I'm helping students do it, so who are writing on these issues. So, yeah.
At which universities are you working with students?
I work with students at University of Washington, University of Minnesota, Colorado State, a variety of UC Berkeley. Say I've had one at UC Irvine. She just graduated. So, and NAU occasionally, so it's just around. People are interested. There's the Water Resource Center here on campus, Sharon Megdahl and her group. I lecture to them and have taken, she's asked me to take a couple of her students under my wing, so educate them. So, I have the luxury now of being able to do that. They can't fire me anymore. even though I did get fired 3 times on the Glen Canyon studies. But
and they kept bringing you back.
I had a guardian angel of sorts, yeah. Several of them over the years, who kept saying, you can't do that. I had members of various administrations who would come on river trips and perhaps consume a little bit and decide they were Jesus Christ and decide to walk across the river and go in and rescue them, and they didn't like being rescued. It hurt their self-image, so I was fired for that once. So, goes to the territory.
Yeah.
Took it personal for a while, but not anymore.
When you're retired, you can afford to be magnanimous more so than when you're working for a paycheck for
something. Well, yeah, though one of the reasons I've had a little bit of initial pushback with you, Paul, is that as of 3 weeks ago, there was somebody in the regional office in Salt Lake who complained about the adaptive management and the fact that I had gotten it started at Glen Canyon because it was costing the Bureau so much money. there's still, even after all these years, people who don't particularly like what we've done. But I would change a thing. Well, maybe a few things, but
let's take a brief break. We can grab something to drink, a little bit of water. I'm going to ask at the front desk if we can extend our time here in the room. And we'll start again in like 5 minutes.
Sure. But I know it's Friday, and you guys probably want to get back to
All right, so I'm going to stop, and we will restart with another file when we continue.